Good evening. I'm Hugh McMillan, and I'd like to give a short talk tonight on my favorite subject, which is the Four Noble Truths. Is there anyone here who has not had any instruction in the Four Noble Truths? Okay. This is a beginner's class. That's what we're here for. One way of looking at Buddhist teachings is that everything is so interwoven that there's almost no place to begin, no place to end. Everything is so interrelated. On the other hand, the Buddha chose in his first discourse to talk about the Four Noble Truths. If we revere him, we can imagine he might have had some idea in that. And I'm perfectly willing to take his guidance in this. There are important teachers who say you can spend your entire time in this practice trying to understand these truths. And by the time you become fully enlightened, you might understand them. So there's a lot here, and this is going to be a very elementary talk, which I will review the Four Noble Truths briefly, and then I'd like to give an example of my own life in the last week or so to bring it down to something concrete that we can hopefully relate to in one form or another, and then hopefully provoke discussion for each of you what that might mean in terms of your own life. What's central to me in the Buddha's teachings is the idea that in response to many questions about reincarnation and the history of the universe and so on, the Buddha is reported to have said on occasion, I am only here for one purpose, and that's to teach about suffering and the end of suffering. Continually pointing toward the idea that there's a sufficient undertaking here just to do that. And to that end, the Four Noble Truths point directly at that practice. What is suffering? What's the nature of it? What does it arise from? How does it arise? How can we possibly get a hold of it and possibly even experience its cessation? So the first noble truth is that there is suffering. The nature of our existence is that there is suffering. It's not that we are condemned to suffer, but it's the nature of our existence that suffering will arise. In Gill's short book, I think he has a helpful thing. He refers to the idea that in the context of Buddha in that period of India, the medical practice of the time would say, you know, there is this affliction, this is how it this is its cause, and this is how we can treat it. And he frames the Four Noble Truths in the same way. He says, there is this affliction. Suffering is going to arise in our lives. The nature of the suffering, that's the first noble truth. The nature of the suffering, the cause of the suffering, is our attachment, our craving, our emotional bind and boundness to that suffering, whether it's an energy of desire, like we want something that's not, we want something to continue that can't, we want something to cease that can't, whatever, whether it's a positive or a negative emotional connection to the experience we're having, it's that emotional and mental connection that gives rise to the suffering. It's not the event itself. There is the idea that in an event, for example, let's take something like a broken leg, there's an aspect of suffering which is pretty inevitable. There's going to be pain. There's going to be some level of pain no matter what kind of mental relationship we have to this experience. But if we watch what our mind does around this pain, we will begin to see that the mind adds a great deal of extra suffering on top of the bare fact of the pain. The fears that arise about, oh my God, it's this bad already. How bad is it going to get? How long is it going to last? Will I ever be without it? Is this going to heal? Am I going to be crippled for the rest of my life? All of those kinds of mental stories that we tell are adding on to the bare essential pain of the first incident, which is the broken bone. The third noble truth is that there is the possibility of the cessation of this optional suffering. There is a way that we can actually come to grips with the experience that will alleviate this suffering. And the fourth noble truth is the specific prescription for treatment, which is basically, I think of it as having two components. One is this idea of middle way, of moderation, of maintaining balance. And integral to that, the Noble Eightfold Path, which is very centered in this meditation practice that we have. And the Eightfold Path is, just to cite it, right understanding, right intention, right action, right speech, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So what he's saying is that it's what we cultivate in our mind, in the way that we undertake to understand what we're experiencing, what we cultivate in our life to minimize the arising of suffering, that is, right action, right speech, right livelihood. And that as we work on that, we get to the possibility of mindfulness about what is actually happening. And in that mindfulness comes the possibility, if we are mindful, of the cessation of this suffering that's been brought about by our mental processes. So with that review, I'd like to now describe an experience I've had over this last week. I'm a technological throwback, so I don't have a Palm Pilot. I have instead a red diary in which I write things rather than write them on a screen. I write them in a book. The book has in it, it's 1 year's book. It has in it pages of daily activities, everyone I ever call, the reasons I call them, notes about what I'm going to say to them, why I'm making the call, whatever it might be. And in the beginning, it has pages of addresses, phone numbers, bank accounts, passwords, basically everything that one needs to conduct their lives, I have in this red book. And I've been doing this for about 20 years, so I have a real attachment to this book. And it really works very well for me. I'd maybe like to learn to use a Palm Pilot sometime. But, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And this works really well. So I'm also spending... I'm going down to Soledad Prison once a week and teaching meditation to the inmates at Soledad. So last Tuesday, 9 days ago, I took this book down because I had written in here all of these notes that I wanted to be sure I remember to tell my fellow teachers and also the inmates. And when I left the prison that night, I left the book in the chapel where we have our meditation group. Now, it also happens that on Friday, Tuesday that happened, 9 days ago, on Friday, 4 days ago, or 5 days ago, 6 days ago, whatever it is now, my youngest daughter was getting married, and part of what was in that book were all the things I was supposed to do between the time of Tuesday and the time of Friday about, Dad, this is what you're supposed to do. So when I got home that night and discovered I left the book there, my mind immediately went to, let's start with, you know, what's actually happened here. There's simply a book that I have some attachment to that's been left in a place where I'm pretty clear where I left it. So it's not really lost, it's just out of my reach for the week until I go back the following Tuesday. Except for the wedding, I could have driven right back there the next day, but because of the wedding and all the things I had to do, that wasn't a possibility. So I was condemned to this week of uncertainty about this book. And then what I'd like to talk about now is what my mind did with that. And I consider this to be all optional suffering. The inevitable suffering about this is nothing. There's just this book down there. And because I have one of these for each year, the book, the amount of new information in this year's book is a small amount of add-on to what was in last year's book. So I really haven't lost a whole lot of vital information. But my mind immediately goes to, you know, I'm so important, I'm so counted on, my kid's going to get married, you know, I never let my kid down. I mean, I started telling myself all of these stories, and I got pretty worked up about the fact that I had lost my to-do list for the next 4 or 5 days. And so the next morning I called a prison to tell them that I'd left the book there, and would they please look for it? And so... of course, when I call the prison, I don't get the inmates. I get the correctional officers. And the prison, they have a lot of angst around this kind of information. There are stories of people who have been targeted for retaliation based on information that's come up about names and addresses and phone numbers. You can just imagine all of the stories that go on in a prison about what the inmates might do if they had this information about somebody on the part of the guards, and on the part of the inmates probably what the guards might do if they had this information about somebody. But I only get on the phone to talk to the guards, not the inmates. So what came back to me immediately was, oh, my God, you lost this book. I mean, that's terrible. You know, what was in the book? Well, I told them what was in the book. Oh, man, that's really awful. So they began to search the prison. They searched it while I actually was on the phone waiting. They didn't find the book. they started asking me where else I might have left it, who was in that class with me. There were about 40 inmates in the class. Anyway, so that's kind of the setting. So over the next 3 days, I began to recognize the stuff that was going on in my mind about, you know, my responsibilities to my child and how I was actually not going to be able to fulfill all of that stuff if I didn't somehow or other get a new list. And I began to let go of this particular part of my identity that had to do with the completely can be counted upon father. But I didn't, because the wedding was going on and there was a lot of distraction around that, I wasn't meditating very much because I had all this stuff to do. I wasn't really sitting down and saying, what's really going on here? And what I found over the next few days was that underneath the fear of failure as their completely reliable father was another fear which had to do with possibly exposing my family to danger. Because in this book are all of my family's phone numbers, addresses, everything. It got to the point that by the Monday night before I went back to prison, I actually woke up in the middle of the night and I had a fantasy. It's one of these middle of the night lying down, your mind's going around and around kind of fantasies where if you would just get up and turn on a light, it would stop. But somehow there I was, trapped in my own stuff, lying in bed and thinking, you know, there's probably enough stuff in that book to motivate somebody to kidnap me and hold me for ransom. My mind actually, you know, grabbed a hold of that. Didn't last a whole long time, but I went there, got in touch with that, and that actually began to trigger the realization of all of the fear underneath about, you know, much more ranging fears about exposure to danger from very unknown sources. I mean, who knows whether this book has even been found by anybody? If it was, who were they? Would it be any more dangerous to be found in prison than out on the street by a guard or a prisoner? I mean, I began to see all of the uncertainty around this, and yet another part of my mind kept propelling myself into this suffering about how bad could it get, which is only my own invention. It's just simply this red book somewhere in prison. That's all it is. So I began to think I actually had a hold on this situation. I was beginning to feel a little bit more equanimity about it. And then I went back to prison on Tuesday, thinking I was pretty much together. But I did really want to go in and see if I could find the book. So I went into prison and ahead of the class, several hours ahead, and I went into the chapel where I teach this class and asked one of the people in there if they would go up to the front and look for the book because there was a class going on I didn't want to disturb. And the inmate went up, and as he was up there walking around, not much further than over here to that corner over there, I began to kind of reconnect with the scene, and I recognized that over in the corner was a stack of red Bibles, and this red book was sitting on the stack of red Bibles completely camouflaged. It had been sitting there, and as I looked at it, I realized, that's my book, and that's exactly the place that I put it. You know, kind of almost like exactly the right angle of how I laid it down there casually. And at that moment, you know, when the guy picked the book up and held it up to me from the other end of the chapel, I felt this incredible wave of relief. And I realized at that point, I hadn't dealt with this at all. I was basically still holding a lot of this fear and a lot of this angst around what would happen if this book wasn't found, how many, literally hundreds of people I was going to have to notify that their personal information was out there floating around, and I had no idea, you know, what the ramifications of that might be. And the very circumstance in which it was found was like the most reassuring possibility. That book was exactly where I put it down, probably untouched in the intervening 7 days. And the guards who had gone in there and searched for it had never seen it. You know, it's like perfectly camouflaged. So I thought, you know, the ending doesn't get much happier than that. And yet, in the process, I saw how even after a week, my mindfulness had not really penetrated to the very essence of my fears. There was still a certain amount of lack of recognition going on, a certain amount of holding. I felt like a real beginner in this practice. So that evening when the class started, I told, you know, this is now a Buddhist meditation class, so I told the story about the book as an example of how one might practice. And the prisoners immediately said, "You found that book?" You know, they shut down the whole prison. They searched all of our belongings. They pulled apart our bunks. They claimed the book had been stolen. And some people in the class said, "There are thieves in our class. We're not going back to that class anymore." And so there was all of this incredible ripple effect that literally involved hundreds and hundreds of people just based on my one moment of carelessness of putting this book down and not picking it back up again. So not only was the suffering in my own mind, but it turned out it rippled out to all of these other people. So we got to talk again about their own suffering, their own stuff about indignity and lack of being treated with respect by the guards and accused of having stolen something and their righteous indignation about all of that. So it turned out to be a great lesson. But I'd like to have had mindfulness a little bit sooner in the week. Any questions? Yes, Michael.
If that's appropriate, I don't know if you can meld that in one of the
two. You mean do I have to stick to the topic at hand?
Well, I thought maybe that's what you tell me that I don't do that.
Huh?
In fact, I came here tonight thinking that's all you were going to talk about is the meditation in the prison. You might think that's
all. I can talk about it. I guess the main thing I like to say about it is that it's not at all what I expected. That it's been a great lesson in the stories that I make up in my mind about how things are going to be, and they don't turn out that way. And there's absolutely nothing about the experience that was the way that I thought it was going to be. I think the most demanding thing about it is that the people that come to the class, first of all, this is a voluntary class. About 1% of the prisoners come to the class of the particular unit of the prison that I'm teaching in. So I don't mean to say I. This is a collective I. There are six teachers, for the evening class that share the time, and six teachers in the afternoon. So there are 12 of us all together. Most of us are from the Mary Orr's group in Santa Cruz, but we're totally open to volunteers if anybody's interested in joining us. So we go down there once a week, and we teach a class in the afternoon. In one of the prisons, there are four prisons at Soledad. Total population is 20,000, roughly. 20,000 prisoners, maybe 5,000 or 6,000 guards. These are very, very rough numbers. And the prisons are, there are four levels of security. The maximum prison, which teach in the afternoon, most of the people in there are in for life. Some of them on three strikes, some of them for very violent crimes. We don't really talk to the prisoners about what they in particular did, so I can't tell you who's in the class in terms of what they've done, but I know that a number of them are murderers. In the evening, we teach in a level two prison where most of the prisoners have some hope of parole, but many of them don't. And the level is based on the perception of the guards of what a danger they are to escape, based on the nature of their crimes, the nature of their history. But my experience with the prisoners who volunteer for this class is I don't know that I've ever felt safer amongst a group of people in my life. I don't know that I've ever felt more appreciated, more warmth. It's astonishing. It's totally astonishing. And what really surprises me, I think, of all, is all after... I mean, most of these guys have been in for... This is all men. There are no women at Soledad. In prison, there are women guards, but no prisoners. Most of these guys have been in prison, I would say, almost all of them over 15 years, and some of them 30. And in spite of all of that experience that we can all imagine they've gone through, there is such a willingness to trust. I mean, I feel with these guys like they want to trust someone. They want to be heard and loved and cared for. And they are so receptive after all of this time. It's just mind-boggling to me. It's really an astonishing experience. What I've found now, I've been doing this for about 9 months now, I guess. I find that it would be very difficult to stop. Because of the importance that this seems to have to these guys. I'd have to have some really good reasons to stop. And I didn't expect that. I think probably after having children, it's the most meaningful thing I've ever done. And I don't even want to rank those two. It's just that I've been having children a lot longer. But it's really a... we have so many ideas about what prison is about based on media, political stuff. It's one of the most I think radical experiences in my life, as I don't consider myself to be a very conventional person politically, but it's still a very radical experience in terms of really understanding how much misperception plays a role in our culture about who these people are and whether they can be rehabilitated or not, and whether they're really a danger or not. And I mean, I really don't know. I mean, my experience about this thing is, this is absolutely beginner's mind. I don't know anything about what's going on in there. I don't know anything about these people. But the emotional connection I have with them is so strong that that's the thing I didn't expect. And it's the pervasive, overwhelming experience. And if I start really thinking about the inequities in the system that we all know about, and especially those that are based on finance and race, it's heartbreaking. But in order to teach this class, I have to be able to somehow hold those two things simultaneously, and at the same time not get overwhelmed by that. And every one of these guys has stories to tell that are just, in some ways, lives wasted. Sometimes for the most apparently arbitrary reasons. And I feel like the distance between me and those guys in terms of life circumstances, about that much, you know. It's just things I did as a kid, as a white kid, that I could have gone to jail for if I was black or Hispanic. Yes?
Can you say a little bit more about the class's reactions to suffering that was caused by it, how they reacted to it and interpreted it?
In terms of this book?
Yes.
You mean? Well, they loved the story. I mean, you know, they had a lot of questions to ask. I mean, first of all, they brought out their own, as I referred to, their own indignities about the fact that they'd been searched, that the guards told them that something had been stolen, which was not true. And it was very clear when I talked to the guards that I had left it there. And then presumably the guard who went and looked and didn't find it then went in his own mind to stolen. So there was a lot of indignity about it, and at the same time when I told them what had happened and they started asking about, you know, well, was I afraid of what they would do? You know, was it based on the propaganda about how dangerous prisons are? And so we actually got into a discussion about that in terms of what guards have said to me and what my own perception of them is. And my feeling about it was, and then when I told them, I actually consider the guards to be more dangerous than they were, because for the very simple reason that the guards had computers at home and they didn't. You know? And so there was a lot of levity around it in the end. Just about me acknowledging, you know, what had gone on in my own mind, the stories my mind made up. I told them the whole thing about being afraid of being kidnapped and held for ransom. They thought that was hilarious. You know, it was, just as an example of where the mind goes, given free rein. And I'm sure if I had another week to work on it, I probably could have made up some even better stories. You know? But that's as far as I got in that one week. You know, maybe I'm just not very creative. So I felt like it was, you know, well, we'll find out. Maybe I'll go back next week and I'll find that nobody comes to the class. So, you know, I can't answer that question yet in terms of, but I had the feeling that there was a connection made around this story that was very positive. But who knows? Well, if there are no more questions, we can have a short sit, and for those of you who can stay, and maybe at the end of the sit, a little, do a short meditation. So it's, maybe we'll sit for about 10 minutes, then I'll do about a 5-minute metta.
One quick question.
Yes.
Every year, do you manually transfer all those names and numbers?
Not all of them, the ones that I consider to continue to be relevant. So, you know, each year I X some people out of my life and I add some more in. But I don't throw the books away, so, you know, I've got it all. Yeah. It's an end of the year ritual.
You must be an engineer.
Huh?
You must be an engineer. I'm making stories. Sorry.
I don't want to spoil your story making, so I'm not going to answer the question.